Good afternoon, everyone. Well, I hope you all had a good day of sitting. Did you? Yeah? Good. It is a great thing to sit in silence all by yourself because nobody knows what's going on in there. but also with everyone, all together with everyone. It's a very unusual thing to do. It's a precious thing. When we practice Zazen, we are sitting in the middle, right in the middle of the great circle of mind, of heart, the great circle of the way. It is, as Augustine said of God, a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Augustine said that. And that means that each one of us is actually, literally, physically sitting in the perfect center of the universe. And each one of us is without boundary. And that's the truth about us. And although this is not a secret, it might as well be a secret because nobody pays the slightest bit of attention to it. And most people never notice it. You can live and die your whole life and never notice. But maybe when we sit in Zazen, we can a little bit notice. Even if you spent the entire day sitting and worrying about yourself and your problems, and you have the feeling that your mind didn't get quiet at all, and you spent the day fidgeting and wondering, why did you ever think to come here today? It was a mistake. Never again. Even so, in the little spaces between your thoughts, your limitlessness is there. And maybe if you didn't sense it there, maybe all of a sudden something in the bowing or the chanting or just in the feeling of the room when you entered, maybe you noticed. Or maybe it wasn't until the bell rang at the end of the period of sitting, just then in that moment that doesn't last very long, just like the moment at the end of a concert when the music stops and there's that sudden silence. Or maybe everything I've just said makes no sense at all to you. What is he talking about? Maybe even then, yes, you had a lousy day with no peace. But now, at the end of the day, somehow you feel a little different, a little more serene. As if something happened that you didn't know happened. And you think that despite how hard it was, maybe you'll come back sometime after all. Since what I'm talking about isn't exactly things that people generally talk about, it isn't exactly an experience in the usual sense, to intuit it is pretty subtle. and it's usually barely felt and barely known. But I think if you pay attention in your practice, you will sense what I'm talking about, even though the words I'm using don't capture it. Words which, by the way, I'm asking now, can you hear those words? Can you hear me? Even in the back, you can hear. Okay, good. All right. I forgot to ask. So even if the words don't capture it, because how could they capture it, you may have a feeling for what I'm saying. In some traditions, they make a really big deal out of this kind of experience, non-experience. But in our tradition, we don't make a big deal out of it. We just take it as a matter of course, a part of being human. And we don't worry much about whether we're feeling it enough or not feeling it or seeing it, not seeing it. Either way, it really doesn't matter. We just go on with our practice, and that's the main thing. In his fascicle called Continuous Practice, Dogen talks about the great road of the Buddha ancestors. What a wonderful phrase, the great road of the Buddha ancestors, which he says is a circle, the circle of the way. And it's true, practice does go in a circle, not a straight line. It's not a journey with a destination. It is a circle, an endless circle that goes round and round without beginning or end. And every moment is that circle, and so is every life. And when we are so worried about ourselves and our lives, really it's a very small worry. And it's a worry full of false assumptions that we're discrete individuals, that our lives are our own creation, our own possession, and that we're supposed to know who we are and what we want. But none of that is actually so. It's all just ideas, viewpoints that we've inherited from our world, our crazy, upside-down world. And when we practice Zazen and encounter the Buddha's teaching, we will come to see little by little how flimsy these assumptions are. Because our actual experience, if we pay attention to it, will show us this. As we begin, little by little over time, to know ourselves in a way that cannot be contained by these flimsy assumptions. And we begin to get it, that we are much larger and much more mysterious than we can know. I was on the airplane the other day and for some reason was reading Emerson, who is, you might know about Emerson. He was a great 19th century American transcendentalist thinker. He was a great friend of Henry Thoreau. He pretty much lived in the 19th century, born at the beginning, died at the end. And he wrote lots of classic essays that express a particularly American way of understanding things. I don't know how many people these days still read Emerson. And certainly in the roughly 150 years since he wrote, there have been so many different and varied points of view developed in America, American thought since then. But still, I think Emerson's thought is engraved in the American DNA. Ideas that we're so familiar with, that we take completely for granted, like self-reliance, the importance of self-reliance, the idea of nature as a source of spirituality and sanity. The idea of always being open to the experience of newness. These are ideas that I think most of us are quite familiar with and hold, and they're basically Emersonian ideas. So one of the Emerson's essays, the one I was reading on the airplane, is called Circles. And he begins by saying, the first circle is the I. And then the second circle is the horizon. And our whole life through, we live in ever-widening circles. And in his essay, Emerson even improves a little bit on Dogen by saying that not only do we live in circles, but every circle draws a circle around itself. So there's concentric circles, each circle drawing a new circle. And he writes, our life is an apprenticeship to the truth that around every circle another can be drawn, that there is no end in nature, but every end is a beginning, that there is always another dawn risen on mid-noon, and under every deep, a lower deep opens. In other words, there really is no end to what we experience and know in this human life. And everything we understand is always only a gateway to further understanding. And so we're always open to that, and we're always ready for surprises. We're always ready for what's coming next, knowing that everything we understand is always provisional for this moment and only for this moment. And that's why Suzuki Roshi says we're always beginners, beginner's mind. We're never experts. Everything we know will always be revised and reconstrued by what we're going to know in the next minute that hasn't come yet. And in that way, there's nothing that's ever truly new. For everything new is old, and yet everything old is becoming new again. As an older person myself, who has done this practice for a really long time, and you can imagine all the different things I've seen in it over the years, good things, bad things, it would be a very natural for me to think that I know what to expect, to think that I've seen it all. And sometimes I actually do think that. But as soon as I think it, I realize, no, that's not true. That's me getting lazy and tired. Maybe I need a nap if I'm thinking like that. I may look or feel old or believe that I'm old, but that's really no more true than it is true that a person who looks young and feels young and believes that they are young is actually young. Because age is a designation, it's a number in the great circle of the way. There's only this moment and its characteristics. And this moment is always both young and old. So we practice breathing and sitting still, very still and silent. And we come to realize that this stillness, this silence, is the true basis of what we are. And that enables us to step backward into this moment and go beyond our limitations. Here's another passage from Emerson's essay, Circles. Oh, this is a little longer. Thus there is no sleep, no pause, no preservation, but all things renew, germinate, and spring. Why should we import rags and relics into the new hour? Nature abhors the old, and old age seems to be the only disease. All others run into this one. We call it by many names: fever, intemperance, insanity, stupidity, and crime. They are all forms of old age. They are rest, conservatism, appropriation, inertia. Not newness, not the way onward. We grizzle every day. Grizzle, a word very seldom used these days. Grizzle meaning grouse, complain. We grizzle every day. I see no need of it. Whilst we converse with what is above us, we do not grow old, but grow young. Infancy, youth, receptive, aspiring, with religious eye looking upward, counts itself nothing and abandons itself to the instruction flowing from all sides. But the man and woman of 70 assume to know all, throw up their hope, renounce aspiration, accept the actual for the necessary, and talk down to the young. Let them instead become organs of the Holy Ghost. Let them be lovers. Let them behold truth, and their eyes are uplifted, their wrinkles smoothed, and they are perfumed again with hope and power. This old age ought not to creep on a human mind. In nature, every moment is new. The past is always swallowed and forgotten. The coming only is sacred. Nothing is secure but life, transition, the energizing spirit. No love can be bound by oath or covenant to secure it against a higher love. No truth so sublime but it may be trivial tomorrow in the light of new thoughts. People always wish to be settled, only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. I was really impressed by the phrase, the instruction flowing from all sides. It's such a true thing. We say in our ordination ceremonies, from now on, all beings are your teachers, human and otherwise. The new truth, the truth of this moment, is always presenting itself right in front of us. Everything, inside and outside, is always showing us the truth all the time. But we don't notice because we're grizzling. We're going around with our crabby mind, and we don't see. We're curating reality moment by moment, and we don't see the marvelous teaching available to us all the time, everywhere we look. Dogen says it like this: let all things come forth and illuminate the self. It's the same thought. In our particular practice tradition, and I think in many cultures and communities, we prize qualities like loyalty and commitment and sustained effort over time. But maybe we also romanticize the bold, creative genius who marches to his own tune without caring so much for anything or anyone other than the fulfillment of what he wants or needs. And, you know, there's something kind of amazing about that, I suppose. But it's an essentially self-centered approach, which in the end is unsustainable and ignoble. When we're younger, maybe we're like that. It doesn't take too many years before you see the sad limitation. Emerson was an unusually settled person. He was born into an old, old New England family, to a long line of Unitarian ministers, so naturally he was also a Unitarian minister. And he had his church, but he didn't last too long. His sermons were too thoughtful and ponderous, and therefore boring. And people said, you know, he's not very good at funerals. And that's the main job of the clergy person. You must be good at funerals. If you're not good at funerals, you're in trouble. So he gave up the ministry, and he spent the rest of his long life puttering and reading and writing and delivering lectures around the vicinity of his home in Concord, Massachusetts, where he lived his whole life. I think you can visit. I haven't done this, but you can go to Concord and you can visit Emerson's house. Maybe some of you have. He once went to Europe, and he met Coleridge and Wordsworth, Carlyle, and kept in touch with some of them, but that was his only travel. He was married twice. His first wife, who he married when she was 18, died when she was 20 of tuberculosis, which happened all the time in those days. Tuberculosis was really common. Two of his brothers also died from it. He himself didn't have robust health. Maybe he had some touch of it. But he did remarry, and he had several children, one of whom, a favorite son named Waldo, died at the age of 5. And he writes about this in his essay, Experience, in a very strange, almost detached and philosophical way. By all accounts, Emerson was a quiet and sober gentleman. Nothing exciting and adventuresome about him whatsoever. But inwardly, he was a person of enormous courage, and he had a great questing spirit. You can hear that in the passage that I just read. He could care less about any external adventures because he was after something else. He was after endless truth and endless depth in living and in the kind of eternal renewal that I expressed in that passage I just read. In these great days that we're living in now, of enormous wealth that, despite the fact that people complain, actually it's spread around quite a bit. A lot of people now have a lot of resources. And there's a lot of publicity about wealth and all the things you can do. You get on the internet for 2 seconds and you're going to see all kinds of places you can go and things you can purchase and whatnot. We have airplanes. We have data. We have amazing machines for discovery and knowledge. We know so much stuff way beyond what they knew in Emerson's day. We can go here and there and do this and that and see and know and experience so many more things than Emerson could have. But I think if Emerson were to be around now, he would not be all that impressed with all this stuff. He would have thought of it, I think, as passing scenery. Because as long as you remain the same inside, as long as you continue to freeze yourself in some frame so that you really can't be opened up and destabilized and therefore grow, then what's the difference how many experiences you have? Here's me in front of the Eiffel Tower. Here's me in front of the Cathedral of Reims. Here's me in front of old Ben. What's the difference? Same me. Who cares where you go? What you see or don't see? Emerson. In nature, every moment is new. The past is always swallowed and forgotten. The coming only is sacred. Nothing is secure but life, transition, the energizing spirit. You know, that's not so different from what the Buddha taught. I think the cardinal teaching of the Buddha is that everything is impermanent. He even said that is so much the case that there aren't any things at all. There's only impermanence. When you make yourself and your life into an object of possession, when you expect and desire the permanence of that possession, you will suffer because you're going to lose everything you think you possess, including your life and everyone you love. But when you realize that from the first, nothing has ever been possessible, then you see that life is always new and that you're always new if you let yourself be. And no matter where you go or don't go, the possibilities for you are without end. And that has nothing to do with your outward circumstances. If you depend on outward circumstances, there's no end to your need. No matter how high you go, why not go higher? No matter how far you go, you need to go further. If you depend on outward circumstances, you are literally doomed. It will not work out. But when your mind and heart are wide open, when you know how to sit in the middle of a circle that has no circumference, the circle of the way that cannot be defined or possessed, the circle that you don't get right and you can't get wrong, then you live with openness and newness always. And then you live with gratitude. Always gratitude, even if you're in the midst of tremendous difficulty, which does come sometimes. So this is a different way to live. And what you might think, well, that sounds good. Much more exciting. But I don't think it's that exciting, actually. I've always been struck by the fact that the word exciting is a commonly used word that means, oh, that's good. That's exciting. This is happening. That's exciting. But I always get a headache when somebody says that's exciting. Because exciting is a problem, you know? Exciting is very addictive. To think you have to be excited all the time. If you're not excited, then you're bored. And you're looking for the next exciting thing. Everything that's exciting is either, it's either 1 minute it's exciting, the next minute it's total dissatisfaction. That's exciting. You know, you think life is supposed to be lived at the peak. But I don't think that's right. I think instead of living at the peak, it's better, and actually, really a lot more interesting, and certainly a lot more thorough, to not live life at the peak, but live life according to life itself. Live life according to the way things go, with everything allowed, exciting or not, and nothing disallowed, without ideas about what you want or don't want, without any brilliant ideas at all, without any reaching, any grasping, or any needing. Just living the way it is, no matter what it is. So instead of living the life you want, I think it's better to live the life of the whole world, however that life is going to appear right here where you are. And that way you're always new and you're always surprised. And if you should be a lucky person, like myself, and get to be old, what they call old, and then notice that your body and mind are beginning to fall apart, this is also very interesting, if that's what it is. Very surprising. Who knew that would happen, right? And completely magnificent. Because if that's how it is, that's what life is. That's the way it looks. That's the way it feels. That's the way it is right now. And it's a poignant part of life, this part of life. Just like winter, when all the leaves fall off, is a beautiful season. How could there be spring if there wasn't winter? And how could there be winter without spring? In his essay, Emerson throws off, by the by, too, what he says, old adages, which I've never heard of. Maybe you've heard of these old adages, but they're very funny. One of them is, blessed be nothing. Did you ever hear that one? I never heard of that. Blessed be nothing. And the other one is, the worse things are, the better they are. I guess people in Concord had a very New England point of view in 1850 or whatever. I said before that Emerson didn't last too long as a minister, which is true. However, he never lost his deep faith in Christianity, as he understood Christianity. And he never lost his conviction that the only life worth living was a life of fully committed spiritual questing. But the problem was that being a minister seemed to him to require that he give up this faith and this quest, and instead be responsible for upholding a received and acceptable static and doctrinal truth. When he strayed from that, his congregants got very upset with him. And he came to feel that to be true to himself, he had to let go of his official status as a person who represented the faith And that's what he did. And I can appreciate this. I feel exactly the same way. And actually, and sadly, you know, we have to admit that this is what happens in almost every religion, including Buddhism. We would like to think, no, Buddhism is different, but no, it's not. And Zen Buddhism happens same there too. Even our blessed, nascent American Zen Buddhism, it even happens there too. Religion is supposed to be a path to open your life and free you from a world that wants to reduce you to something small and manageable. But religion is supposed to free you from all that. And Zen, of all the religions, is the most explicit in saying this. But I don't think Zen is unique. I think every religion is supposed to do that for us. But every religion always becomes the opposite of that, because it becomes a path of conformity. It becomes a path of closing instead of opening. And that's why a lot of people who see that point very clearly will reject what they call organized religion. They might come here thinking this is more disorganized, but but no, this is another organized religion, sorry. So, you know, people say, I'm not going there. I don't need any of that. And I guess that would be true if we were all as exceptional as Ralph Waldo Emerson. Maybe we could get away with it. He did. But I think most of us are not that exceptional. And most of us would not have the capacity on our own to surpass ourselves. We need a little help. But not seeing that, we only see the restriction and we give it up and we go about our way thinking, wow, I'm free. I grew up with a very restrictive religion and now I'm free. But really, we've just rejected a kind of formal restrictiveness for an informal, even more restrictive restrictiveness called me. Isolated me. So it seems to me that we're better off receiving the inspiration and support of religious teaching, practice, and community. But we always have to pay attention, every one of us, to the ways in which we allow ourselves to let this practice restrict us. And it's really up to us, each one of us, to make sure that we don't let that happen to us. Now, it's a little subtle, because after all, is restriction evil? No, there's always some restriction. There's nothing wrong with restriction. Is religious conformity evil? No, there's nothing wrong with religious conformity. There's going to always be religious conformity. It's part of what happens in this world. It can't be eliminated. So it's not like we're running around saying, no, everything, correcting everything that looks like it's not what we think it should be. The trick is to have our eyes open, to have compassion for what we see, even when it's limited, and not allow ourselves to be confused by it or taken in by it. Because religion really is not identity. It's not a club that we belong to that we have to defend and protect. And no religious teaching is a settled truth that we're supposed to uphold. It is our job, we have been given this job at birth, to live our life with courage, openness, and kindness. And when we notice that our religion is not helping us with this, we have to think again. But it won't do to blame the religion or the religious leaders, because it's our responsibility to find the truth that's unique to our particular lives and to use our practice and our tradition like a can opener to help us see what's inside ourselves. As I read, he writes, no love can be bound by oath or covenant to secure it against a higher love. No truth so sublime, but it may not, no truth so sublime, but it may be trivial tomorrow in the light of new thoughts. People wish to be settled only as far as they are unsettled. Is there any hope for them? We can bind ourselves without knowing we're binding ourselves with our religion. And also, we can bind ourselves without knowing that we're binding ourselves in our human relationships. To be really loyal and true to one another doesn't mean that we have to cooperate with one another in our mutual bondage. And in Dharma relationships, this is so clear. We're supporting each other to go beyond ourselves, to be the best that we can be, to be Buddhas together. Dharma relations, and I think at their best, this is true from human relations, as Emerson writes in another one of his essays, Friendship, that I remember reading closely many years ago. All of our relationships should not really be person to person. They should be Buddha to Buddha. And in the Dharma, that is explicitly clear. And sometimes this means gently challenging one another when we see that our friend is limiting themselves, giving in to fear or afflictive emotion. It happens sometimes, and we can be sympathetic and gentle, but at the same time, remind the person that they know better, and that now is the time to remember, not to forget your practice. And I really think that in the end, there is nothing more important or more helpful to any human being than the Dharma. Not the Dharma as a set of rules and teachings, but the Dharma as a dynamic and open way of life that shows us how to overcome our painful attachments and to have the capacity to step forward with courage into the next moment, whatever it brings. One last a quote from Emerson. The one thing which we seek with insatiable desire is to forget ourselves, to be surprised out of our propriety, to lose our sempiternal memory and to do something without knowing how or why. In short, to draw a new circle. Dogen says this too, doesn't he? To study the self is to forget the self. And Dijong's famous saying, not knowing is most intimate. These are both to forget, study the self is to forget the self, and not knowing is most intimate are very, very commonplace Zen adages. So familiar with them that they almost stop meaning what they say. Nevertheless, they are true. look closely, and I mean closely, at your own experience. See how it is that your thinking tames you and hems you in and removes you from your very own experience. And go beyond your thinking and see how, in a moment of real presence, you have forgotten yourself. You are no longer yourself. Just life is happening. Coming and going. Here and everywhere. No one can stop it. No one can understand it. No one can define or measure it. With everything we know now, all the data, all the information, every moment is like recorded. Every thought practically is recorded and stored somewhere. We could easily have the illusion that we know what's going on in the world. It's a whole business now to tell you what's going on in the world. Now there's more analysis than there is news. You know? We don't know what's going on. We do not know. We know something. Sure, a lot of stuff. We know a lot of stuff. It's impressive. But it's very little. And all the things we know are maybe not the important things anyway. And that's why we do really, really need to step back into silence every day, into the spaces between our thoughts, into the mystery of what we all are. And we're as intimate with this mystery as we are with our own breath and our own body. All of us are here for a very brief moment. It's shocking, really. It's shocking. We're here so briefly. We're flashing into existence and out of existence. And we're flashing in and flashing out, and round we go, back and forth in great circles. Although the whole world does this, and we're joined in it by everything and everyone, the whole world is that circle, the whole world is that mystery, the world is in a trance, literally a trance, and it doesn't know that. And we're in that trance too. Because how could we not be? And every day, we take a step back into silence. So we remember who and what we really are. And little by little, we learn how to live accordingly. That's our practice. And it can make us really happy, even though bad things happen. Really terrible things happen. They won't stop happening. We can be happy, truly happy. And we can be of service to those we love and to everyone else too. So I always say this, you know, but I feel it so deeply. I mean, I really appreciate you guys for being here and knowing all this. Otherwise, you're not here, right? It's the stupidest thing in the world to waste a whole day doing nothing. You could be somewhere else having a good time. It's stupid to do this, unless you know this. So if you're here, you know this. And it's very encouraging to me to see a whole room full of people who know this. I hope you will continue your practice in whatever way is given to you. And we'll keep going too. We'll keep going too. Some of you may be new to our community. Sometimes people don't realize that everyday Zen is not the same as Green Gulch. We're just renting space. Everyday Zen exists in the sky somewhere. Green Gulch exists right here. So we're just renting the space. And Everyday Zen is everydayzen.org. That's our home. One of our practices at Everyday Zen is, for those who don't know, we always, instead of having questions and answers after the Dharma talk, we have small group discussions so that you can tell two other people what your understanding is of the Dharma. And the way we do those groups is in the room here, we self-organize into groups of three. We do it very quickly. We move our cushions around and we sit in little clutches of three. And then everybody gets 3 minutes of uninterrupted time to just spontaneously speak to a question that I'm going to pose in a moment. And then at the end of that 3 minutes, a little bell rings, and the second person, and the third person, and then there's usually a little bit of time at the end to wrap up. And the idea is to just look inside yourself and see, how do you understand right now? What's your understanding right now? And then after that, there's usually time for us to reconvene as a group and have some further discussion. And so the idea is, the commitment is that we are listening to one another respectfully, without critique. We're not asking each other questions or commenting on each other. We're each giving a monologue. And we are not going to repeat to anyone else what was said so that everybody feels safe to say really and truly what's on their heart. So it's amazing how well this works. We've been doing it for many decades. So that's what we're going to do right now. And here's my question to you. You can speak about something else, that's always allowed, but it's good to have a prompt. And my question for you is, how do you see your Zazen practice, the practice we've been doing all day, as informing your everyday life, meaning your view, how you view your life? Does it change your view of life? Does it not change your view of life? Does it have anything to do with the way you look at your life? That's what I'm asking you to discuss. Whatever comes to mind for 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes. So now with that online, people will get organized into groups, and here in the room, we'll spontaneously organize. And then the whole thing takes about 12 minutes or 15 minutes, and then we'll reconvene. So thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it.